This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Previously on the history of Singapore. Working with the British and PAP Secretary General Lee Kuan Yew, Singapore Chief Minister Lim Yew Hock has successfully broken the left-wing decolonization movement by instigating violence, then pretending he didn't instigate it, and using the violence as an excuse to arrest all the leaders of the left-wing anti-colonial decolonization movement, and framing Lim Chin Siong for instigating the violence. But this was temporary. Eventually, an election would have to be called, and the left-wing would be able to contest the election and would definitely win. So Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew had to find a way to fix the election beforehand to ensure that the left wing could not run. How could they do that? Find out today in this week's episode of The History of Singapore. Hello and welcome to The History of Singapore, episode 31, The Big Geelong. In July 1956, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser unilaterally nationalized the Suez Canal, the vital strategic channel for shipping between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean via the Red Sea. It had been previously been owned and controlled by the British and the French. And the British and the French, of course, were upset. But together with Israel, they completely bungled their response. Starting on 29th October 1956, they staged an elaborate wayang, where the Israelis invaded, thus giving a pretext for the British and French to then invade as peacekeepers rather than aggressors. Despite a successful seizure of the canal, the world saw through this deception, and the United Nations, United States and Soviet Union forced the British and the French into a humiliating climb down. It was an event which signified the end of Great Britain's role as one of the world's major powers. The political and psychological impact of the crisis also had a fundamental impact on British politics. British Prime Minister Anthony Eden was accused of misleading Parliament and forced to resign from office on 9th January 1957. Eden's chief military advisor during this period was one Field Marshal Sir Gerald Templer. Yes, the former High Commissioner of Malaya, the man who came up with the bright idea of fighting the MCP by forcing rural Chinese into concentration camps. That guy. Eden's successor, Harold Macmillan, greatly accelerated the process of decolonization and sought to recapture the benevolence of the United States. How? Well, going forward, the British were forced to take a more conciliatory stance towards anti-colonial nationalist movements, to be much more collaborative and magnanimous, in order to both accelerate decolonization while retaining control of events and achieving outcomes in the colonies that were favourable to the British. Fortunately for them, by the time the Suez Crisis happened, Lim Yew Hock had already smashed Singapore's anti-colonial movement for the British. This was accomplished from August 1956 onwards, and indeed, the detention without trial of the leadership of the left-wing anti-colonial movement was completed mere hours before the Israeli invasion of Egypt. What luck for the British. Following his smashing of the anti-colonial movement, Lim Yew Hock was welcomed back to London in December 1956 for discussions for a new date for constitutional talks. Given his actions, people in Singapore, including the press, predicted that the arguments with the British government over internal security that brought down the previous set of talks would not reoccur. Why would the British be worried about internal security now, when all the anti-colonial left were locked up? It was thus to the surprise of the Singapore public when Lim Yew Hock proposed that the British retain significant control over internal security via the same Defence and Security Council plan that Marshall had proposed a year before. A Security Council comprised of three representatives each from Singapore and Britain, plus the seventh member, one Federation representative as chairman. The Nanyang Shangbao demanded, "What was the recent affair for, if not to prove that Singapore could handle its own internal security? Why do we still need this structure with Singapore in the minority? Is this not the half a loaf that was rejected by the former chief minister?" There was widespread general puzzlement why Lim was conceding more than he needed to. And the newspapers concerned, especially the vernacular newspapers, reminded him not to concede Marshall's other important achievements, especially multilingualism and citizenship and a fully elected legislative assembly. It was announced that the formal talks would take place in London in March 1957. Citizenship in particular was a real worry for the Chinese. This was reinforced on 20th February with the release of the Reid Report on the Constitution of the Independent Federation of Malaya. The Nanyang Shangbao and the Xinbao both noted that the Reid Report did not offer universal qualifications for citizenship based on place of birth. That was contrary to the four proposals jointly submitted by 1,094 registered Chinese public bodies in the Federation to the Reid Commission. This discriminated against the Chinese of Malaya. And also, the Reid Report declared that Malay and English were to be the official languages. The combined Chinese public bodies had declared that they would accept either Malay as the only official language of Malaya, or all four major languages as official languages, i.e. Chinese, Malay, English, Tamil. But promoting only English alongside Malay was a continuation of colonial discrimination. The Nanfang Evening Post highlighted the fact that the report had been based largely on the alliance's recommendations, as the British considered that the alliance represented the majority of Malayans. The lessons for Singaporeans was that they had to participate in politics and ensure that their views were represented in the political parties, especially in the governing parties, or they risked being left out of the process. The report impacted the ongoing negotiations in Singapore at the all-party conference, which had been called to discuss Singapore's position at the constitutional talks. UMNO Singapore overruled their party leader, Hamid Jumaat, by introducing 9 demands for special rights for Malays based on the Reid Report to the all-party conference. And they were met with angry protests from the other parties, the Labour Front, the PAP, the Liberal Socialist Party, and so on. So Tunku Abdul Rahman then had to come in and mediate, and UMNO Singapore agreed to lower their demands. But this dispute held up an agreement, which was finally reached on the 1st of March 1957. The size of the overall delegation was reduced to just 5 people. The Chief Minister, Lim Yew Hong, the Education Minister, Chew Swee Kee, the two of them representing the Labour Front, UMNO Singapore leader, Hamid Jumaat, PAP leader, Lee Kuan Yew, and Liberal Socialist Party representative, Lim Chun Mong. A final problem was the timing of subsequent elections. After the constitutional agreement was passed, there would be a new set of elections. Now, Lim Yew Hong had twice promised elections by August 1957. Members of his Labour Front Party wanted an early vote. August 1957 was fine with them, because the PAP would still be weakened from having all their popular left-wing anti-colonial leaders locked up. The PAP rank and file also wanted an early vote. August 1957 was also fine with them, so that they could soon, quickly throw the Labour Front out of government. And then once they got into government, they could release their colleagues and end the use of repression, end the use of detention without trial. But Lim Yew Hock and his ministers knew that their popularity remained badly damaged from the detentions and from their education policy, which discriminated against Chinese schools, and so they did not want an early vote. Lee Kuan Yew, the PAP Secretary General, also did not want an early election, as would hand the advantage to the left wing, the base, the rank and file of his party. Because you see, the election would undoubtedly elect more left-wingers, forcing him to deal with them and diluting his control of the party. So what to do? Well, Lemuel Hoch spoke to Governor Black. And Governor Black then asked Colonial Secretary Allan Lennox Boyd if he could, quote, pull his chestnut out of the fire for him during the talks by saying that it will not be possible to have the new constitution ready by August, unquote. And so the British agreed to justify a delay in the elections logistically. The excuse would be that in order for new citizens to vote, an act would have to be passed in the British Parliament and new voters registered to create a new voter register, which would delay voting until late 1958 or early 1959. But more importantly, by this time, Lemuel Hoch and Lee Kuan Yew had reached what Governor Black called an understanding. Lim needed Lee Kuan Yew's cooperation in order to win the next election, while Lee Kuan Yew needed Lemuel Hoch to help remove the left-wing leaders from the PAP and keep Lee in charge of the PAP, and they knew an early election would be bad for both of them. And so, encouraged by the British, who desired a coalition government that included both men and excluded the left wing, they worked quietly together to delay the elections and to eventually eliminate their mutual opponents, the PAP left wing and David Marshall. In mid-January, Lee Kuan Yew, ever the clever lawyer, suggested a legal manoeuvre to Lim Yew Hoch. He noted that, quote, the law can be altered to prevent detainees like Lim Chin Siong and Devan Nair standing for election to the assembly, unquote. See, the problem was that as they had not been convicted of any crimes, they were still eligible to run for office. Lim raised the issue with Black, explaining that, quote, neither he nor Lee Kuan Yew could possibly take this up during the March talks. He said it would have to come from the Secretary of State in some form as to say that one condition of the grant of a new constitution must be the exclusion of detainees from the right to stand as candidates for the Legislative Assembly. This is therefore another chestnut which the Chief Minister hopes that the Secretary of State will pull out of the fire for him. And he assured Governor Black that neither he nor Lee Kuan Yew would demur if the Secretary of State laid down this condition during the talks. Now, mindful of Britain's damaged worldwide reputation, the Colonial Office was very reluctant. Officials noted that being in jail had not prevented Kwame Nkrumah from winning the Gold Coast 1951 election. The Gold Coast, of course, later known as Ghana. What Lee and Lim were suggesting was unprecedented in any British colony. Officials suggested that the best way might be for detention of officials to simply physically prevent the detainees from signing their nomination form, which would be, quote, sharp practice, but it might be less objectionable politically than deliberately providing constitutional instruments to disqualify detainees. In reply, Governor Black pointed out that Nkrumah had not been a communist. He suggested that Allan Lennox Boyd emphasized the need to protect Singapore from, quote, communist subversion, unquote. There's that bogeyman again. At the same time, he tried to convince Lim to take a public stand on the issue, but Lim refused and insisted that the idea had to come from Lennox Boyd, because being held responsible for such a decision would destroy what little anti-colonial credibility he still retained. Meanwhile, David Marshall stood for the Labour Front presidency at the party's AGM on 23rd and 24th February, but was defeated. And several resolutions important to him, including the amendment of the Banishment Ordinance and the holding of elections in August, were also defeated. Marshall was considering resigning and forming his own party, which might then draw the support of the PAP left and the trade unions, who were frustrated with Lee Kuan Yew's leadership. So Lee Kuan Yew advised Lim Yew Hoch to press forward quickly, get the Assembly's approval for Lim Yew Hoch's position, and dash off to London. Governor Black reported that, quote, if talks were held now, Lim and Lee Kuan Yew apparently believed that timing will stifle Marshall, who will have to behave during negotiations in case Singapore acquired bad name, blame for which would thereafter be visited on him, unquote. And so, Lim quickly called a Legislative Assembly meeting for the 5th of March, while Marshall was away in Brunei. In Marshall's absence, Lim Yew Hock explained that the logistical difficulties facing Singapore would prevent August elections, and the Assembly agreed, yes, it's better that everyone gets to vote. The Assembly approved the agreement unanimously and quickly, concluding the debate in less than 2 hours. When Marshall learned of the debate, he rushed back to Singapore but arrived 4 hours too late. An angry Marshall accused Lim of timing the Assembly meeting to ensure he could not attend. But it was too late. The next day, the delegation departed for London. The delegation arrived in London on 7th March. The chief discussions were technical in nature, centering on the structure of the government. The Defence and Security Council was separated into an internal security council and an external security council. The talks were also overshadowed by the ongoing Cyprus emergency, where, just like the Malayan emergency, freedom fighters were also fighting for decolonization from Britain. At the same time, overall, the mood in Singapore was much more introspective, focusing on the challenges facing Singapore once the talks were concluded, rather than on the talks themselves. And discussion continued to centre on the timing of elections. In general, it seems that the press accepted that a general election was pointless if it excluded the 200,000 people who would gain citizenship under the new constitution. And a press survey of the public found that they generally accepted this position as well. Of course, they didn't know that this was a deliberate line being put forward by the British and by Lim Yew Hock in order to excuse the delay of elections. On the other hand, 19 left-wing trade unions issued statements supporting David Marshall and agreeing that colonial rule had to be ended as soon as possible. Having early elections would allow Singaporeans to choose which party they wanted to implement the new constitution, to implement self-government. And others argued that a new government would not be democratic unless citizenship was broadened first. So this debate went around and around, and the Sin Chew Jitpo and the Nanyang Siangpak eventually endorsed waiting. Although the Sin Chew Jitpo suggested instead as an alternative, a national all-party coalition hold office in the meantime. On the 30th of March, news reached Singapore that the constitutional talks had been concluded successfully. Coming the day after the release of Cypriot nationalist leader Archbishop Makarios from exile, the newspapers heralded a new era in colonial history. Coincidentally, the governor of Cyprus during the Cyprus emergency, one Sir John Harding, who was commander-in-chief of the British forces in Malaya during the Malayan emergency. So one of the themes that you'll see, actually, if you look at colonial history, is the impact of Malaya and the things that happened first in Malaya, which were then repeated throughout the rest of the empire. Malaya, in many ways, formed the template for how the British dealt with other insurgencies like Cyprus, like Kenya, and so on. Anyway, the newspapers congratulated the Singapore delegation for its unity, unlike the last time, and fervently hoped that this unity would continue until independence was achieved. And these beliefs were stated and restated by the newspapers after the signing of the formal agreement on 11 April. Under this agreement, 260,000 foreign-born residents gained citizenship. Singapore achieved virtually universal suffrage. A 51-seat, fully elected legislative assembly was created. Everything except external affairs and defence would be under local control, and the head of state would be a Malayan. This last was celebrated as an unprecedented achievement never before conceded by Britain to any of her self-governing territories. A Sin Chew Jitpo poll of leading politicians found that, apart from David Marshall, they favoured the postponement of general elections until citizenship registration was completed. 1 year would not make a major difference. To elect a new government to remain in office just for a year or so and then prepare for another election would be a waste of time and money. But Governor Black quite succinctly put it another way. The Labour front's ministers, he wrote, quote, would prefer to remain in office and enjoy their positions for some time to come, unquote. But for Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew, one major problem remained. How could they fix the next election to ensure that one of them would win? In a fair election, the PAP left wing would clearly run away with it. They were hugely popular with the majority of the electorate, having done the most to advance the welfare of the people. Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew needed to ensure a way to make sure they could not run. What could be done? Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thumb. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, The Big Gelong. Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew had successfully negotiated a new constitution for Singapore, but one major problem remained. How could they fix the next election to ensure that one of them would win? In a fair election, the PAP left wing would clearly run away with it. They were hugely popular, having done the most to advance the welfare of the people. Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew needed to ensure a way to make sure that the left-wing leaders could not run. What could be done? Well, they did it by fixing the election. The day before the official signing, Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew privately and separately met with Alan Lennox Boyd to discuss a clause banning the left-wing leaders from running in the election. Now, the fact that they met separately is very important. Lee Kuan Yew insisted on this because this then enabled him to say later, with absolute truth, that he did not meet with Lim Yew Hock and Alan Lennox Boyd. So, when he was accused of fixing the election by meeting with them to insert a clause that prevented the left-wing leaders from running, he could say with 100% truth something like, I did not meet with Lim Yew Hock and Alan Lennox Boyd to discuss this clause. And it would be completely true because he met with Lim Yew Hock and then he met with Alan Lennox Boyd. He did not meet with Lim Yew Hock and Alan Lennox Boyd. You see the distinction? Lee Kuan Yew was already thinking of how he could escape on a technicality. And he even sent a memo to Governor Black later, reminding him of this position and reminding him that the British could also use this same position to back up Lee Kuan Yew if anyone accused him of colluding with the British and Lim Yew Hock. That's Lee Kuan Yew for you. And don't forget, the whole clause was Lee Kuan Yew's idea to begin with. The British want to do it. And Lim Yew Hock was a trade unionist and a politician. He couldn't think up of these legal maneuvers. It's Lee Kuan Yew, the lawyer, who comes up with the idea of a clause. So he meets with Lennox Boyd to discuss this clause in the constitutional agreement to prevent the left-wing leaders from running in the election. He had proposed this clause back in January. And specifically, the clause would be to bar anyone who had been detained for subversion from taking part in the elections. Not convicted of subversion, just detained for subversion. In other words, the government could detain you just to prevent you from running. They could arbitrarily block anyone from running in the election merely by saying, okay, we are going to detain you without trial for subversion. And Alan Lennox Boyd agreed to it on the condition that they also convince the shadow colonial secretary, Nye Bevan. But funnily enough, Lennox Boyd had more trouble convincing his own cabinet. They were really worried about the UK taking responsibility for such a blatant act of repression. But Lennox Boyd talked them into it. And so the next day, Lennox Boyd, Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew performed their own big wayang. Lennox Boyd announced the requirement of the clause. Lim and Lee pretended to be angry and denounced it as an act of fascist repression. And Lee even protested, this is totally true, he protested, quote, "There is no guarantee that the government in power would not use this procedure to prevent not only communists, but also democratic opponents of their policy from standing for election," unquote. That is really cheeky, given that that is exactly why he proposed it. And so after a brief adjournment, the delegation decided to sign the agreement under pressure. They would, quote, "take note," unquote, of the condition. What the hell is that? Take note. And place it before the Legislative Assembly for its approval upon their return to Singapore. In Singapore, of course, the clause was furiously condemned. The Sin Chew Jitpo predicted that it would put the Labour Front in an awkward position because it could be accused of using the clause for its own political benefit. Obviously, the Sin Chew Jitpo did not realise that was exactly what the clause was for. More broadly, combined with the Internal Security Council, this agreement expressed an excessive mistrust of Singaporeans. The Sin Chew Jitpo very sarcastically commented that the agreement looked less like a constitution for a state than a, quote, "set of regulations for a student society. The elected committee is responsible for planning the welfare of fellow students, but all important matters must be approved by the principal." So after attaining self-government, Singapore must carefully observe the agreement and behave well in order to get a chance for independence, unquote. Likewise, the Nanyang Shangbao called it senseless and undemocratic and urged the delegates to reject the clause. It argued that the clause demonstrated how irrational the British fear of communist infiltration had become. Singapore's economic, political and geographic environments would simply not permit communist rule. The population had embraced democracy with great gusto. Singapore was heavily reliant on capitalism and entrepôt trade and surrounded by very virulently anti-communist countries. None of the objective conditions existed for a communist regime. The Nanfang Evening Post concurred. They said, not only would Singaporeans never welcome a dictator, but Singapore could not support one. It was simply impossible. The Nanyang Shangbao Sunday Leader sarcastically said that Singapore was, quote, "buying self-government in installments. If we work well and keep up the good credit, we may achieve independence in the future. Otherwise, dot, dot, dot," unquote. It didn't finish the sentence. So there was markedly less enthusiasm than the successful delegation might have expected on their return to Singapore. A rally at the Padang drew a mere 5,000 people. That's a lot fewer than expected. And the cheers were perfunctory. Merdeka. 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 In general, people appreciated what they had gained but weren't happy about this ridiculous subversive clause. It was a reminder that Singapore's future was still not their own. We were being treated like children. And the political leaders condemned the subversive clause but agreed the mission was a success. With the chief exception of course, David Marshall, who condemned the failure of the mission and resigned from the Labour Front in protest. When the agreement was put up for debate in the Legislative Assembly, an angry David Marshall accused the delegation of betrayal and duplicity. He noted that the agreement signed by Lim Yu Hong was nearly word for word identical to the agreement he had negotiated and rejected, and where it was different, it was worse. Previously, the Internal Security Council's decisions were advisory, but now they would be taken in secret and were binding. This was undemocratic. What had all the repression of the previous year had been for if Singapore was going to get less freedom than before? Because of these clauses, because of the ISC, the British would still be able to exercise repression with no accountability to the people of Singapore. The new constitution, said David Marshall, quote, "makes no change to the essential colonial spirit of our status," unquote. and he also noted there was no date for the implementation of the constitution. It remained up to the governor as to when to implement the constitution, if at all. So Marshall moved an amendment to the motion demanding an immediate implementation of the constitution, and he argued that this whole excuse that logistically they would have to wait for another year was ridiculous. Using identity card information, he pointed out, and a minor amendment to the electoral law, voter rolls could be prepared and inspected within 3 months. A new election could then be held, and the new government would then have a mandate to implement the new constitution. He had faith in Singaporeans and believed the public of Singapore to be far more sophisticated than the assembly assumed. Of course, what Marshall didn't know was that this whole logistical excuse was agreed between Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew and the British as an excuse to delay the elections. The logistical excuse really didn't exist. Marshall was completely right that they could have altered the electoral rolls and created a new electoral roll pretty rapidly if they had wanted to. And finally, and most importantly, Marshall pointed out that the subversives clause was eyewash. It was ridiculous. The British would never have jeopardized such a carefully negotiated agreement via a sudden last-minute inclusion of the clause. That was not their style. It was politically foolish to upset an agreement that took so long to negotiate, and for such an oppressive reason. The opposition Labour Party would have had a field day in Parliament if so. And the Singapore delegation, led by intelligent men, would have known this and should have immediately rejected the clause. Saying they were quote-unquote taking note of the clause simply made no sense. Marshall concluded the only logical conclusion was that the delegates had concurred with the clause, or maybe even come up with the clause, but they were using the British as cover. And very colourfully, Marshall said, Lennox Boyd was, quote, acting as the indulgent host to skittering mice who are taking hospitality a-hiding in his coattails, unquote. He accused Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew of rank hypocrisy. If Lim Yew Hock was willing to put politicians in jail without trial, it was no less democratic to prevent them from standing for office. Lee, meanwhile, had made no attempt to obtain the release of his colleagues or repeal the Preservation of Public Security Ordinance because it suited him to have his erstwhile colleagues in jail. Marshall said, quote, that is the only explanation consistent with the action taken in London. To suggest that a minister of Her Britannic Majesty's government is going to meddle in this petty little thing and risk a whole agreement is asking more of credibility than even the people of Singapore can stand, unquote. And he was right. Marshall had nailed it right on the head. But Marshall's attempts to amend the motion failed. No doubt many in the assembly took the colonial government at their word when they said the left wing were subversives. They didn't know better. But I think at the heart of it was a lot of self-interest in the assembly. No one wanted to run against the left wing anti-colonial leaders because they would lose. Everyone wanted to win. And ultimately, only David Marshall and Lim Chee Keng voted against the motion. The motion passed and the subversives clause became law. The entire left-wing leadership remained behind bars and none of them would be able to run in 1959. It would be another 40 years before Lee Kuan Yew admitted in his autobiography that the whole thing had been fixed all along, by which time, of course, David Marshall was dead. You thought a bunch of people fixing football games was huge? Lennox Boyd, Lee Kuan Yew, and Lim Yew Hock kelonged an entire election. The left-wing base of the PAP were naturally furious with Lee Kuan Yew and his duplicity. They had built up the party and now found it hijacked by Lee Kuan Yew's personal agenda. They would seek to reassert control of the party and rein in Lee Kuan Yew. A confrontation was coming. Join us next week as we witness a struggle for the soul of the PAP. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjtham. Thank you very much and see you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.